So even within the Tibetan community, of course, there were more affluent families, such as the aristocrats. And there already we can see the effect of the parental difference of the parenting. For example, in the aristocratic family, in some cases, which is not always the case, but in some cases, the parents may leave the actual parenting to someone else, like, you know, nannies or... And especially, for example, the mothers may refuse to give milk Even the Buddha himself is said to have been reared by a whole group of nannies.
His mother died.
Yeah, I mean, he was an aristocrat.
Yeah. So, but
his mother died also. He had no chance of being reared by his mother.
So here we see a situation where the mother or the parents somehow feel kind of distant with the parenting and wouldn't get into the kind of the messy bits of, say, you know, nappy changing and all of that. So already the effect can be seen on the child because there is a kind of a greater distance between the parent and the children. And perhaps what we see in the West is a something similar situation because parents are so busy. You know, they don't have time and so on.
That's how you say about it.
That's how you say about
it. So, you don't need to say it. You don't need to say it. You don't need to say it. You don't need to
say it.
So, you don't need to say it. You don't need to say it.
So, because of this deep belief that, you know, that at, when we are children, we have the appreciation of the basic human values is much more pronounced. I often tell people that in many areas of life, perhaps we should be more childlike. Even when we fight, you know, we fight and then we can immediately make up if we are more like childlike.
I think you may notice, in my book, I mentioned, say I quite often fight with my elder brother. Oh, my nail or my weapon. But no traces of sort of ill feeling. Fight! A short moment, separate. They went like this. Brother there, I just look like crying sometimes. Then few minutes, forget. Play together. I think that's better. Isn't it?
You said too, he always let you win.
Oh, did. So, I think compared to brothers, I'm more aggressive. So he always submit me.
So probably Solness was saying that he has been spoiled by his brother.
I thought it would be very powerful to draw attention to these cultural differences in child rearing. A way to make it more to make it powerful would be to provide empirical evidence that there are differences. So wouldn't it be interesting to take your questionnaire and determine whether the percentage of securely attached children in Tibetan communities differs from the West? And another thing I'd like to know is whether there are socioeconomic class differences in secure versus non-secure attachment in the West, I mean, of the data that we already have.
Yeah, I would want to look at it before I said. I don't think they're really strong in some ways for this reason, that there are some poor families who, you know, are doing a security providing job, but just for the reasons you said, I would expect there to be some, because the all of these systems we're talking about respond to stress. You know, just as you're indicating and Michael indicated, you're in a situation where you can't calm yourself down and don't have the resource to provide things. It makes it harder. This is related to something we were talking about too. In this kind of poverty that his holiness experience was fairly normal in an extended community, extended family, and so on. So I think what we see in the United States, where poverty means you can't get the things you need, you can't travel from one place to another, you can't... I see it in my daughter's school, which is actually a very good one, but a public school. The minority children, and there it's minorities of different kinds, I grade their homework once a week, so I see how everyone is doing. And the minority kids don't have the same degree of help from their parents. So I think there are many stresses on the family that probably translate into this, but there is good evidence about it. I haven't memorized it.
I guess my main point is it would draw attention and the power of Western science would be brought to bear on the different child-rearing practices if they were shown to exist.
Yes.
If you could show that there were more securely attached Tibetan children, then this would really focus a lot of energy on unpacking what it is about child-rearing here, and then people might listen to this, whereas if you just say, well, my mother or his mother, you know, like if you get hard numbers, I think it might make a difference. I could be wrong.
Yeah, you were sort of saying it doesn't make much difference. It hasn't made
I still hold the faith that people would actually respond more strongly with the evidence in front of them.
Yeah, what I'm interested in doing is trying to figure out what these issues are. I mean, we can't study them empirically today, but I think just identifying them. Another one that interests me is the PTSD study that we're saying, this trauma symptoms. While I've been here this week, many people have said, even though the Tibetans went through terrible experiences, they did not seem to have the degree of PTSD symptoms, you know, a long-lasting trauma. And that's another, that's an important empirical question, but if that's true, that would be very interesting.
But important to document that.
And just to bring that back to Rusty and Michael's talk, we know from modern evidence now that the hippocampus is involved with PTSD, and so a diminished rate of PTSD would be associated with healthy hippocampi. And so there are direct brain correlates of these differences that I think would be very interesting.
There's another factor that I've been thinking about for a number of years. I've traveled in a number of Buddhist countries, and I've always felt that the cultures were generally much more friendly and much more open-hearted than the Western cultures. And I've thought about what possible differences there could be. And one thing that occurs to me is that in the Buddhist tradition, there's a sense, the whole tradition is imbued with the concept that each of us has Buddha nature and is inherently, has the capability of becoming a Buddha if we purify the obscurations. And so there's a sense, it seems to me, of belongingness that is just fundamental to the culture, that we belong, that we are part of, and our parent, and I would imagine that the parents respect that in the children, that they look at the children as infant Buddhas, and they have been treated as infant Buddhas. And one of the things that I've gotten from this meeting is that the most determinative factor is the attitude, you know, the embodied attitude of the parent. Now, in the West, it occurs to me that the dominant theme is that we are outcasts, that we have been cast out of, we've been cast out of, and we live in original sin, and we have to claw our way back. And that may be a very, very fundamental difference in these cultures that could account for a lot of this stuff.
Buddha ne je riju da re shukshum shtar da re shukshum shtar da da di ta ma shi yada no ju da khadori chenju se betten ne na ro ti shi yare ta sanskrit buddhism na ti yare ma da pali ta shtar na shukshum ai ha ma da ji ma re ta ne 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 ma re ta ne
ma re ta ne ma re ta ne
ma re ta ne ma re ta ne ma re ta ne ma re ta ne ma re ta ne ma re ta ne ma re ta ne ma re ta ne ma re ta ne ma re ta ne ma re ta ne ma re ta ne ma re ta ne ma re
The notion of the Buddha nature as such, or the Sanskrit term actually suggests Buddha family or Buddha clan, that we're all of the same. That's really only to be found in the Sanskrit literature and the Mahayana Buddhist literature. You don't really find that in the Pali literature, early this form of early Buddhism or Theravada. It's not there. But when a Solanus is being raised, and he experiences spontaneous compassion from his mother, he is quite confident that she knew nothing about the Mahayana Buddhist teachings on Buddha nature. That was not a factor. nor did she have any idea of the present, the kind of the nature of liberation, the path to liberation, kind of a theological view of Buddhism. Not there at all. So it was something coming from another very different source. But if one is looking for something that is unique or at least very unusual in Buddhist countries or Buddhist societies, it would be the theme and the emphasis on compassion, not only for one's own clan, one's own race, not only just for human beings, but the sense that all sentient beings, without exception, are deserving of compassion. And that's something that really may be quite unusual for Buddhism.
Culturally, this is very, very strong, and this is a very instinctive in people's mind. I remember an anecdote where I was traveling with 20 of our monks in France. We were in a big bus, and a bee came in, and the driver, just because he thought maybe if he's tongue, he might not drive properly, he took a newspaper and did that. It's sort of natural instinct. But I could see the 20 monks immediately, they were... It was totally instinctive. This is something that no one will do, and this is taught from childhood, this kind of positive nonviolence, not just like being passive, but just the idea of meaninglessly harming or not being aware that this is a sentient being, this is a perceiving suffering. That gives a kind of a softness to actions, thoughts, and behavior that's really pervading and gives that kind of gentleness.
One occasion in the Prague, Czech Republic. Yeah. I think Czechoslovakia. I participated in one meeting and a break, lunch. And I just saw the crowd just sitting there.
Solens was saying he remembers very vividly once he was in Prague. It was the Czechoslovakia then, and at a conference. And during the lunch break, he was having his meal in the corner, and then there were two rather elegant-looking ladies who also were joining the lunch. And then in that hall, there was a fly, and one of the ladies, without any thought, just squished it. And then his holiness had to restrain his reaction because he knew it's culturally. It's just so normal. But for him, it was just a completely, so it was a strange situation.
I think that did it under evolution. I think from the view of the evolution, climate condition also may be differences. Sometimes I do feel that. You see, the Asia, now today I think too much population. But in ancient time, naturally, it's a small population, smaller, much smaller. So then is the climate condition, the fruit or vegetables, these are plenty. So there is no sort of, I would say, by nature, you see, not much sort of anxiety for survival. The northern world, Europe, cold, long winter, then they...
For example, I mean, this may be just an anecdotal experience, evidence, but in India, if there is a sunshine, people just take it for granted. Whereas in Europe, if there is a nice sunny day, it's a big deal.
I think there, perhaps in ancient time, the life not that easy. So you say hard work for survival. Mm-hmm. Then also the thinking, the isolated, surrounded by sea. See. So the more technology. Then expand. Mm-hmm. Colonial rule, mm-hmm. all these imperial rules. Yeah. Whereas Asia, generally, as I mentioned earlier, life, not that much anxiety. That also care.
That may be one factor, but it's just...
But I
speculation.
There's an amusing study, Your Holiness, which was done by a social psychologist in the United States. And what he did is, on a rainy day, he had his students call people randomly
and just ask them how happy they are. When it was raining and cloudy, and a very large number of people, and then on sunny days, he had his students do the same thing, call a large number of random people on sunny days and just ask them how happy they are. And it turns out that on the sunny days, people reported themselves to be more happy than on the rainy days.
So as I was saying, this could probably be true. Of course, again, there will be individual differences, because it's only saying that the school where his elder brother went to, in Lhasa, it was a school, they had a day off when the weather was bad, and it was actually known as the weather bad day off.
So they enjoyed
so
that.
For them, if you ask them, you know, are they happier? When the weather's bad, they would probably say yes.
Well, maybe we can move on to another topic that we'd like to pursue with you, Your Holiness. In Phil's presentation, he illustrated a method which is being used extensively by psychologists. The method is called priming. And in Phil's examples, he was using words such as love, warmth, words like that, that he flashed on a screen to induce changes in experience and in behavior of the participants in his research. He also had other kinds of priming where he had people imagine examples of situations where they felt secure and so forth. Now, we began to think in our discussion at lunch that there appear to be many things in Buddhist practice which in some sense are analogous to our Western concept, to our Western method of priming. Practitioners will, for example, have pictures of their teachers. They will intentionally remind themselves to adopt certain behavior throughout the day. And in Phil's experiments, he was using priming as an intervention to actually promote positive behavioral change, to increase levels of compassion, to increase the extent to which people wish to help other people, to be altruistic. And so this is another area where I think we can profit from hearing Your Holiness talk about examples from the Buddhist tradition of this sort that we potentially can incorporate in our research to help us produce more effective change when we use these kinds of priming techniques.